Welcome to this podcast of Sunday nights on ABC Local Radio. I hope you enjoy the program. And now on Sunday night, it's a great pleasure to welcome back to our studios an old friend and author of the most recently published Beyond Belief, How We Find Meaning With or Without Religion, Hugh McKay. Hugh, welcome.
Thank you very much, Sean. Lovely
Thanks
to be here.
So much for joining us once again. This book is a journey that puzzles over the persistence of the religious impulse and the nature of the virtuous life. What led you to write it?
From the point of view of a social researcher, there are some irresistible features of contemporary Australia, John. And to be absolutely frank, I mean, there's a bit of a personal journey in this too. I mean, this book was a working out of some of my own stuff. Books always change you, and this book changed me. But just looking at contemporary Australia from the point of view of a researcher, what a fruitful field. Here we have a society in which a mere 8% of the population go to church once a week. It edges up to 15% once a month or more often, and edges up further to about 25% at Christmas. Add in carols by candlelight all over the place, and it's probably about a third. So, but that's a fringe activity now. That's an eccentric thing to do in Australia, to go to church weekly. Yet, in the last census, 61% of Australians ticked Christian. And in a recent ANU National Social Science Survey, 68% of Australians said they either believed in God or in some higher power. So there's an interesting, rather confused picture. Further confused by the fact that while church attendance has been going through the floor, enrolment at church schools has been going through the roof. So we've got all these parents who may be ex-churchgoers or never churchgoers, but want something about Christianity. For the national figure now is about 40% of secondary school pupils are enrolled in non-government schools, overwhelmingly either Catholic or Anglican. In New South Wales, it's up to, I think, 50% of secondary school pupils. So they're saying there's something there. They like church schools. They like Christian hospitals, you know, they expect more caring teachers, more caring staff, all that sort of stuff. And another fascinating little bit of research, among non-churchgoers, 88% say they like having a church in their local suburb. They don't intend to go, but it's as though they like to know that sort of stuff still goes on. And they assume, even though, and we can talk about this later maybe, even though the institutional church is on the nose in Australia, like many other institutions, not just the church, but certainly the church is suffering a terrible slump in public esteem. But at the same time, there's this feeling that the individual believer, the local faith community, is likely to be good for us, likely to be good for the broader community. These are good guys, you know, they're likely to be more compassionate, etc., even though we don't esteem the institution that they represent.
Just talk about those raw figures. It strikes me there's an interesting parallel with sport there, that people who actively go to sport or attend sporting events in a week are around about the sort of same percentage as religion, that is, it's down around the 14% or less, yet you still have this huge identification in the population with sport generally.
Yes.
Even if they're couch potatoes, they're still committed to the idea of sport.
Yes, yes.
Religion hangs around in that same way.
Yes, it's a very interesting very interesting parallel. I think that's true. I mean, some people even go so far as to say sport is the new religion. I don't think that's true. I do, however, think that if Karl Marx were looking at Australia in 2016, he would not say religion is the opiate of the masses. He would say sport is the opiate of the masses.
That religious instinct we have, I think in some ways it's reflected in the first piece of music you selected for us, that little Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, by one of the great religious composers of these days, John Rutter, who seems to pick up a sensibility that's both secular and religious at the same time.
Very interesting observation. I chose that track because if you listen to the words, I mean, it's rubbish. It's the old children's rhyme, Matthew, Mark, Luke and John, bless the bed that I lie on, etc. So ignore the words, but he does this sort of ethereal thing that creates quite a, you'd almost say a kind of spiritual moment out of something as simple as that. Now, I think that that Rutter is a very interesting symbol of a kind of soft revolution that's going on both inside the church and on the fringes of the church and more broadly in society, which is people saying, we don't want to sign up to the dogma. We're not captivated by the institution. In fact, we don't trust the institution. We don't respect the institution. We don't want to tick all those boxes about literal belief in this or that, virgin birth, resurrection, creation, Trinity, whatever. But we don't want to get sucked into the contemporary me culture that says, look, it's all about being a consumer or it's all about being happy. There's more to life than me. And if I'm going to try and find some sense of meaning and purpose in my own life, I'm going to have to find something larger than the self to put my faith in. And so there's this whole, what I think, even though the word spiritual is very slippery and very hard to interpret, but it's a kind of spiritual hunger, spiritual yearning. One of the blokes I spoke to, a young student I spoke to in writing the book, said early in the conversation, I'm SBNR. And I said, yeah, never heard this. Oh, yeah, all my friends are SBNR. In fact, in the census, you know, we tick no religion, but we write in SBNR. This is ignored by the Bureau of Statistics. I said, okay, what is it? Spiritual, but not religious. And that turns out to be a huge Western movement. In an American survey of young adults, aged 18 to 30, I think, over 70%, 72, 73% said that they're spiritual but not religious. That, by the way, the author of that research report said, if this is a signpost to America's future, churches will be closing at a faster rate than General Motors dealerships. But that's the movement. And I think you're right. I think Rutter and that sort of music captures it. You know, we're not asking you, it's not about dogma. It's about being more open to the idea of faith in something beyond the self.
Let's talk first briefly about the factors in the decline of religion over the last 40 years, because it's been clearly identifiable since the mid-60s, yes, and it continues.
Yep.
What's interesting about it is there seem to be reasons that have to do with the external culture and the rapid rate of change in the external culture, but also something about religious institutions themselves.
Yes.
Let's talk about those broad cultural factors first.
Yes. Yes.
What are the key cultural factors?
I think, and you're right, I mean, the decline can be explained outside and inside. The biggest cultural influence, John, I think, has been a relentless bombardment of propaganda that's come from two very different directions but leading to the same conclusion. One is the increasingly pervasive and very sophisticated, very effective, and very relentless bombardment from the consumer mass marketing industry that has been saying with increasing sophistication and popping up everywhere, even in social media, it's all about me.
And it's highly individualised.
Yes, that's right. It's not about us. We're asking you to buy this stuff in order to make yourself feel better, not in order to improve the well-being of the neighbourhood or your community. But this is about you. You're entitled to material comfort and even prosperity, and we're a rich country. We're not quite so rich now as we thought we were, but you should be part of this. And if you've been spending and buying all this stuff and you're not feeling better, that just means you haven't yet gone quite far enough. So borrow a bit more. If you doubt whether we've been seduced by that, just look at our record levels of personal and household debt. So that's been at us. But what's also been at us from a slightly less expected direction has been the blandishments of the happiness industry that for the last 25 years has been saying the default position for humans is to be happy. You're entitled to be happy. If you're not feeling happy, there's something wrong with you. Buy our book, watch our TED talk, come to our conference, pop a pill. There's all sorts of pharmacological pathways to perpetual happiness. And again, this is not about the well-being of the community or improving society or making the world a better place. This is all about me.
There's also a change in the intellectual climate, one that has led to a broad distrust in institutions, in given truth.
Yes.
And this isn't just about religion. It's,
yes.
It's right across society. It goes yep. to the universities. It goes to civic institutions.
Yes.
It goes to government. One could
the
see
media.
In the current election campaigns around the world a distrust with politics.
Yes.
That politics is in some ways failing.
Yes.
That in universities it might be called post-modernity.
Yes.
That is, it's a relativization of everything.
Yes. Yeah, very true. And that comes alongside all of this bombardment, the vestiges of postmodernism, which are saying, effectively, everything is subjective, everything is relative, there's no absolute truth, everything is subject to interpretation.
And my interpretation.
My interpretation, yes. So you may be my teacher, I may be your pupil, but I disagree with you. I don't think that was the cause of World War II. I'll tell you what I think was the cause. And my opinion counts the same as yours. So that, of course, as you say, leads absolutely to a mistrust or a declining respect for the institutions that have relied on their kind of status in our society as repositories of truth and wisdom.
Internally, institutional religion, which the mills of God grind slowly, has almost been overcome by this like a tidal wave.
Yes. Yeah, that's right. I mean, it's as though we've been faced with a choice. You know, would you rather be rich and happy and entitled to your own opinion about everything, or would you rather be kind and compassionate? You know, this is, and the church and the messages of religion have been losing that contest. But not only because of the factors as the external ones, but because of what they've been doing as well. The point you made earlier, John, about the internal factors that have propelled people out of the church.
Well, let's talk about a couple of those internal factors. One of them is this way in which religious institutions largely move very slowly. They encase truths and gild them with ritual, and you have to unpick, like unpicking a fine weaving, to
yes.
actually pull the essence out of the surround quite deliberately, because they've been meant to enshrine things almost as stone.
Yes.
And that has not proved effective over the last 50 years.
Yeah, that's true. And dogma is the sort of representation of that. You know, here are the prescribed, here's the received wisdom, here are the prescribed doctrines, the things you must believe. And as you say, this changes very slowly. It occasionally does change. Occasionally the Catholic Church will announce that they were wrong about something and now stop believing that and start believing this, like babies going, unbaptized babies going to limbo, etc. Yes. Whereas, of course, I mean, whereas belief is static, dogmatic, prescribed, faith is none of those things. And I think, you know, part of what's happening now is people are saying, I yearn for some kind of faith. I identified faith envy as a current phenomenon in Australia, people wishing they could have some of this, but not at the expense of their reason, and certainly not at the expense of having to give in to beliefs they just couldn't espouse.
Has there been a failure here in the part of the churches internally in this very area of faith and reason? For 100 years, serious theologians have been unpacking the historical Jesus question, yes. For example.
Yes.
And they've carried this knowledge and discussed it in universities and discussed it in theological halls, but in the pews,
yes.
It's remained unstated largely,
yes.
Unless you happen to move in the last 20 years into one of those progressive Christianity groups.
Yes, yes. And they, of course, are signposts to the future as well. But no, I think this is right. There's a little section in the book where I talk about what constitutes professional misconduct for a clergyman in the context of a story of a clergyman who strayed and, you know, left his wife for the wife of a parishioner, etc. Professional misconduct, maybe, or human frailty, maybe. But, you know, the point that I'm making is professional misconduct for a clergyman, analogous to professional misconduct for an accountant or a lawyer or something, for a clergyman is keeping the congregation in the dark, exactly what you've just said, keeping the congregation in the dark about what theological scholarship is actually discovering.
And in the last 10 or 15 years, we've had people like Jack Spong come to the country talking about, you know, the fundamentalism and his view on religion. Crowds have flocked to it,
yes.
And all of a sudden said, hang on.
Yeah, why haven't we been told
why
this?
Why haven't we been told this? You actually say it in a way that resounds in the back of my head with the sorts of things I've been feeling.
Yes.
Thank you, I don't need to go to church anymore. It's a very nice feeling.
Yes, yes. Don Cupid, the same thing. Paul Tillich before that. I mean, there's this procession. John Robinson with Honest to God, that book that swept the world in the 60s, swept the Western world. This procession of theologians who've been looking at ways to I mean, in a way, it's the post-Nietzsche phenomenon, John. I mean, there was Nietzsche saying God is dead. He was not saying there is a being out there somewhere that has died, so let's have a mass funeral. What he was saying was that supernatural idea of God has lost its hold on Western culture. The idea that God, you know, some supreme being is the author of our morality, it has lost its force. We know that morality operates in a different way. And so in the post-Nietzsche period, I think you could interpret what's been happening in Christian theology as saying we've been trying to redefine, reimagine God in a way where talking about God being dead or alive would make no sense at all. It's not that kind of thing. It's really the move from the supernatural out there God to the more spiritual in here, within and among us God.
This presents a difficulty for Christianity which Judaism and Islam don't confront. That is, with Christianity, the supernatural becomes incarnate. And it locks you into a view that begins with those first books, the first gospel writers, that Judaism and Islam aren't confronted with.
Mm. Mm.
God with us.
Yes.
And what is meant by that. And the traditional Christian interpretation has been a highly supernatural one.
Yes, that's right. Whereas, as you're suggesting, the cutting edge of contemporary Christian theology is not supernatural. And I embrace that really in the book, saying that the movement, that the idea of God incarnate, which is traditionally, institutionally interpreted as meaning Jesus was God, you know, God appeared on earth in the form of Jesus, could be reinterpreted to say God incarnate means God is in us. This is where you find that the divinity. Karen Armstrong, the contemporary, I suppose you'd call her a theologian, historian, says divinity is an aspect of humanity. And, of course, you look into the New Testament and you see statements like God is spirit. Very interesting change in contemporary translations. In the King James Version, we had God is a spirit. Now we have God is spirit, which I think a very significant shift. God is love. So these are not supernatural concepts. These are very human concepts. We know what spirit is. We have the spirit of the age, the Christmas spirit, the school spirit, the spirit of enterprise. The spirit of loving kindness seems to be a very contemporary way of defining what God is.
One other question in this area. in response to all these changes, there seems to be a sort of almost a paradoxical response. You have one group of Christians who are moving off into this progressive Christianity area. You have another that seem to be retreating into a security of fundamentalism and a particularly highly emotional fundamentalism that you see in the charismatic movement.
Mm-hmm. Yes, there's growth at two ends of the spectrum, really, at the moment. And one is that, the charismatic, Pentecostal, Hillsong, Metro, Christian City Church, Assemblies of God, all of that, highly experiential, not particularly interested in dogma. I mean, they wouldn't interpret it necessarily the way I'm about to interpret it, but very much saying, let's experience in a dramatic, almost a theatrical, highly sensory way, let's experience the Spirit within us. And at the other extreme, there's steady growth in the very opposite kind of liturgical experience, which is the sort of English cathedral approach, which is also in its way very theatrical, stained glass, beautiful music, incense, banners, processions, etc. So there's a kind of the thing that's growing is not let's get the dogma straight. The thing that's growing is let's wrap ourselves in this. Let's experience something that gives us a sense of the God within.
Yes, the interesting thing is they are both experiential. One always demands community conformity into the experience. The other says, no, we will design this so you can be alone with your experience.
Yes.
That is, you sit in the cathedral and it wafts over you and allows you to be who you are in that context.
Yes, it does, although, of course, it is corporate, it is communal. But you're right. In fact, many of the people that I spoke to in researching the book talked about that very point, that they one of the things they like about going to a cathedral or to a fairly restrained but large congregational experience of church is that they're not obvious, you know, that they can lose themselves in this, they can be quiet, they can be contemplative, and no one's kind of noticing them. They're not expected to do anything, even if they don't say the words of the creed. No one knows they're not saying it.
And they're not told how to interpret it.
Yes, yes, that's right. It's absolutely open to make of this what you will. You can sing the hymns without believing a word of the text, but being transported by the whole experience.
You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia through Radio Australia via the web to the world. Our guest is Hugh McKay talking about beyond belief, how we find meaning with or without religion. Hugh, let's get a little bit of that transported experience into the studio. You've selected some Bach for us.
Well, the master. Interesting. I mean, one of the things religion does for people, no question, but so does some other kind of spiritual experience, is inspire them. It gives them visions of a better world and so on, and certainly inspired many composers, poets, painters. J.S. Bach, preeminent among them. He said, you know, every word he composed was dedicated to the glory of God. So I've just chosen a short non-choral, I mean, most of what we think of as his religious music is choral. This is just a piano concerto, a movement from it. One of my favourite musical forms, the theme and variations, which I love because it seems to say to me, there is always more. You can always peel away more layers. There's more meaning in this than you first thought. So this is Bach being utterly religious in what we would think of as utterly secular music.
Concerto in D major, the Allegro, the third movement. You're on Sunday nights on ABC Radio around Australia. Our guest is Hugh McKay. Hugh, let's talk then about why this religious disposition persists. And as you indicated at the very beginning of our discussion, it seems to be much wider than Christianity. One could immediately go, of course, back to Bach and say, well, look, this is a way of bringing together things that are sort of disparate. Aesthetics, ethics, instinct, they come together here. Mm. All of them pretty foundational aspects of the human person. Mm. Religion binds them, well, religare, to bind.
Mm. Yes, yes, exactly. And when you look at all the benefits, when you look at the power of faith, when you look at the power of myth to inspire us and encourage us and so on, and when you look at the power of the tribe, the community, you'd say religion ought to be riding high, especially in a society like ours where so much social change has buffeted us and we've got an epidemic of anxiety and depression on our hands. Wouldn't people turn to religion in droves? No, they're turning to spirituality in droves. But as we were saying earlier, the church is very good at driving people away, not only because of its dogmatic, rather straight-jacketed approach, but also, I mean, I've lost count of the number of people who've said, both in research and just anecdotally, I left because it was boring, or I left because it didn't seem to have any relevance to me at all. Or, in some very dramatic cases, I left because I was asked to leave because I didn't measure up. People said, well, if you believe that, you don't belong here. You're not welcome here.
Why then is it that it persists? And I think one of the things you point to in your book is that religion has provided a way of enshrining some of those things which are most difficult for us as humans to sustain. And I mean the capacity for self-denial.
Yes.
That religion codifies it not just for the individual but for the group.
Yes.
And gives a sustaining way of dealing with that into the future.
Yes.
That is, one can project one's self-denial not just to me and my immediate family but across generations.
Mm. Mm. That's true. And by the way, we have to acknowledge that around the world religion is increasing. You know, it's not, you know, we talked about the decline, but that's a phenomenon in some countries, including ours, but it's not the global phenomenon. The global phenomenon is the opposite. By the middle of the century, 80% of the world's population will be attached to one of the four great religions.
Well, indeed, you could argue that things like ISIS or even the Taliban are supported by some people because they're better than what went before.
Yes.
That is, the corruption that won't be... They might be harsh,
yes,
they might be absolutely demanding, but at least they're consistent and clear. And you know where you stand in relation to that.
Mm.
And they do offer a way for the community to build itself out of the chaos in which it finds itself.
Yes, yes. And the post-Mao China, I mean, an extraordinary phenomenon. There's 100 million Christians in China. By the middle of the century, China will be the world's biggest Christian country. But, note, it will also be the world's biggest Muslim country. Obviously, I was going to be around to see that, John. What a fantastic social experiment.
It takes one to the Voltaire line, though, doesn't it? If religion didn't exist, it would be necessary to invent it.
Yes, that's right.
Because
that's
it provides that foundation for morality,
yeah,
in the absence of anything else that's tangible, yeah, and meaningful for the individual.
Well, and I mean, just while we're on Voltaire, the great non-believer, he said, you know, I'm not a Christian, but I want my wife, my lawyer, and my tailor to be religious, because then I'm less likely to be cuckolded, cheated, deceived, etc. In other words, his view was religion is exerting, he couldn't buy it for himself, but he saw that it was exerting this powerful force for good in the community.
And that's not to say that you can't devise a morals, consistent and coherent moral structure that's free of religion. Of course you can. What Voltaire seems to be saying is that you can do that, but what on earth is going to actually make people want to conform to it?
Mm. Yes, and there are two answers to that, but coming back to your previous question, there's no doubt that regular church attendance, regular religious practice of some kind, or even regular spiritual practice, yoga, mindfulness, meditation, etc., the discipline of the regular, particularly the communal participation in some sort of expression of faith, is what we need in order to nurture these very charitable, loving, compassionate, kind dispositions that are within all of us. We won't necessarily persist with that without the encouragement and support, for example, of a faith community or of some other like-minded community that shares the discipline with us. So that needs to be nurtured. The good news, though, about all this, I think, is that biologically, those dispositions are in us. Like, it is part of the human destiny to be cooperative. We are herd animals. We absolutely rely on communities to sustain us and support us and protect us. And those communities rely on us to engage and nurture them. So that's in our DNA. We can easily lose track of it. We can easily become competitive. But our destiny is very much in accordance with the messages of most religions. Let's love one another. Let's treat other people the way. How else is a community going to work?
The DNA argument, by an interesting sidetrack there, of course, was dominated perhaps for the last 10 years by the Dawkins argument about the selfish gene, that we're actually predisposed to selfishness.
Yes.
Of course, that's been overtaken in the last couple of years by arguments about the altruism gene, that is, which is the most dominant. So even in sociobiology, you're getting this argument. It flows through literature in the great debate of Valentine's great book, Coral Island, reflected in Golding's book, Lord of the Flies.
Yes.
The argument about which impulse is the strongest.
And I think, I mean, far be it from me to sound grandiose, John, but I think the argument is settled. I mean, I think contemporary neuroscience, which is now peeping into the brain in ways we could previously only imagine, is saying cooperative is who we are. The other things we do, the sense of being in, the whole obsession with personal identity, who am I, has been a terrible distraction for us. You know, when the ancient Greeks said know thyself, they weren't saying stare in the mirror or gaze at your navel. They were saying know your place, know where you fit into Athenian society. That's what that message really implied. And I think part of the answer to this apparent dilemma about am I an individual or am I a member of a family, a community, a church, a nation, whatever, a species, the whole idea of personal identity is actually a social construct. You'll never identify yourself except in the context. You don't see yourself in the mirror. You see yourself in the faces of the people who love you or will put up with you.
Yes, in anthropological terms, in biological terms, we are a communal species. That is, we weren't created as a distinct individual. We evolved as part of a group.
But they've always been tribal, one way or another, that's correct. Yeah. And one of the curious things about the contemporary period of social evolution we're going through in the West, which we touched on earlier, the so-called me culture, the obsession, rather narcissistic obsession with the self, this is a denial of our destiny. So it's destined to be short-lived.
And it states something about the current wave of economics, that is that the whole obsession with economics is something about the individual actor.
Your hip pocket.
Being overtaken by arguments about economics having to take into account the fact we're actually social animals and we need
to make sacrifices in the interest of the greater good, all that.
It spills out everywhere. Let's then cut to the chase. You spend your time sort of working down through this book to get to a point where you say, what is the essence of what we really should be about here? And you get to it right at the end by spending a chapter talking about what was Jesus really on about? And then what is he saying and how that reflects on what we are on about.
Yes.
And you spend your time saying, but actually Jesus came into the picture as somebody who was attacking institutional religion.
Exactly.
That he is about being someone, not believing something in a way.
Exactly. Yes, I went back to the source documents, as I should, in a book like this, the Parables, Sermon on the Mount. Whoever wrote them, however they got into the form they're now in, they are generally accepted as the sort of received repository of the values that Jesus taught. And what are they? Exactly what you just said, John. What are they about? They're not about believing anything. They're all about how we'll respond to each other. They're all about a very, it's a big call. It's beyond what we think of as conventional morality, just treat other people decently and you know, get by. It's stuff about redefine the meaning of neighbour. Neighbour is not people like us. Neighbour is anyone, including people we don't like.
Yeah, neighbour is not my tribe.
Yeah, that's right. Which was a huge affront to the Jewish, the Old Testament view of neighbour. So that was revolutionary. Turn the other cheek, go the extra mile, love your enemies.
And it's extended in the best of Paul's writing too. He extends that, he says, there's neither Jew nor Greek, nor male nor female.
Yes, yes.
And Paul's great writing on the essence of love.
Yes, exactly. Yes, the thing that gets read at everybody's wedding.
Yes, believer or not.
That's right. So that's where I got to as well. I mean, I think it's where everyone gets to. You know, it's the tradition of every mystical tradition, every religious tradition, but also every moral tradition, really, that we because, and it's because of this biological fact about us, that we are tribal creatures. We are herd animals. We won't survive without each other. We won't survive without the insight that we are all one, that what happens to one of us is part of what's happening to all of us. And the way to respond to that is in a spirit of kindness, compassion, tolerance, respect for otherness. I mean, if I could wave a magic wand, I would now say, let us all accept that there's a huge range of beliefs in our society. There are people who want to say they're atheists. There are people who want to say they're theists, agnostics, Catholics, Protestants, liberals, conservatives, progressives, etc. Fine, I respect all of that. But those are the things that divide us. Those are the things that often produce bitter enmity within members of the same tribe, even the same religious tribe, let alone the human species. If we could just get beyond that and say, look, it's not about that. It's not about any of these labels. And the teachings of Jesus were not about any of those labels. They were about being more loving, being kinder, being more compassionate, being more tolerant. Do we think that's the pathway to a better world? Okay, if you're on a religious journey, if you're on a spiritual but non-religious journey, your destination is almost certainly the same. When you dream of a better world, it will almost certainly be a kinder, more compassionate, more loving, more mutually respectful world.
And that doesn't mean you don't make judgments. Oh, it actually means you acutely refine your judgments.
Yes, and you make judgments about arguments and about positions. You don't attack the people who hold those positions. We could transform Parliament, John, if we could just introduce this idea.
There are things such as a step too far. Christopher Hitchens, the great atheist, the polemical leader of atheism, as he almost wanted to see himself at some stages, also revealed a different side of his character in a discussion with his brother back in 2010 for the Pew Forum, when he said, look, Christendom destroyed itself in two disastrous world wars. It had helped shape a civilization and a culture. But I am not yet sure if we've found anything to replace it.
Hmm.
He is acknowledging that independent of its sort of stuff about supernaturalism, there was a great civilizational role here for religion.
Hmm.
And he was a bit cautious about whether we'd been able to find anything to supplant it.
Hmm. Mm.
He almost seems a fellow traveller with you here.
Yes, that's right. That's right. You wouldn't think so from many of his public utterances and writings, because he seemed very much in the Dawkins camp. And, of course, he's right in what he said about the effect of World War II and the implications of World War II. I've quoted Dietrich Bonhoeffer in the book, the German theologian who was executed for his part in the plot to assassinate Hitler. At the end of World War II. And Bonhoeffer makes the point very similar to Hitchens. In fact, he says, now I can no longer really believe in institutional religion. The fact that all of these so-called Christians, members of the same churches, were all out there killing each other. Bonhoeffer was in total despair, yet he never lost his faith. he remained Christian to the very end, but utterly despairing of the future for the church as he then saw it. So, strangely enough, from a very different point of view, he and Hitchens were coming to the same conclusion. I think we are going to need the revolution that I think has started, which is away from the institutions that so many people now despise and that Hitchens despaired of, and Dawkins certainly despises, and many contemporary Australians do in the light of the Royal Commission into Institutional Child Sexual Abuse, of course. But that doesn't mean that the yearning for a sense of meaning based on something larger than ourselves that informs our moral being, nurtures our spiritual dimension, all of that, that yearning is as powerful as ever. And I think it's in the progressive end of the Christian church and in the spiritual but not religious movement outside the church that we're starting to see the response to this. Don't just write me off as a mindless individual, narcissistic. Don't just write me off as a materialist. So many people are now saying, I am a spiritual being. I don't buy the church. But actually, when I hear about what Jesus taught, I could go. I think that's all these people who are ticking Christian but not going to church. They're probably clinging to that idea. There's something there that's really valuable. I don't see it in the institution, but I do. I may see it in the school that's teaching my kids, or I may see it in a meeting of people who are interested in exploring their spirituality, or I may see it in my yoga class. Most people who go to yoga don't think of themselves as Hindus, but they often do say there's a really spiritual dimension to the yoga experience.
It does take me back to the old hymn. Blessed be the tie that binds our hearts in Christian love. The fellowship of kindred minds is like to that above.
Yes, 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 that's right. And what binds us turns out to be not whether we believe in virgin birth or Jesus turning water into wine. What binds us ultimately is the sense that we are one, and the one is not confined to the people in or out of a particular denomination or a particular church, and that because we are one, the spirit of loving kindness is what we have to engage to make this thing work.
Hugh Mackay, great to talk with you again. Lovely to have you with us. Hugh Mackay's new book, Beyond Belief, How We Find Meaning With or Without Religion, is in your bookstores now, published by Macmillan. And Hugh, we will conclude with another sort of aesthetic experience of the transcendent. You've chosen the Rouffler for us.
Yes, this is Ubi Caritas, the first line of which translates as, where true charity is, there is God. And I think this is the Jungian view. It's very much the contemporary theological view that where true charity is, that is what God is.
Hugh Mackay, thanks so much for joining us. This has been a podcast of Sunday Nights on ABC Local Radio. Thank you for listening.